mud, but keeping her footing. "He's here," she shouted. "Homer's here." At the door, everyone turned.
"How do you know?" demanded Beauvoir.
"Chief Inspector Gamache told me. Said to tell you to go inside. Tracy might be..."
"Mad,"
said Beauvoir, and reached for the door handle as the two agents reached for their guns.
"Holster them,"
said Lacoste. The door was locked and solid. They threw themselves against it just as Cameron arrived, the human battering ram. Putting his shoulder to it, the door burst open. As he rushed in, Beauvoir wondered, very briefly, where Gamache was.
Chapter 40.
"Tell him I'm following Homer," Gamache shouted after Cloutier as she ran to warn Beauvoir.
Then he turned back to the prince, one set arriving, one set returning. Gamache followed the boot prints into the forest. After a few steps, he paused and looked around. He knew then where Homer was heading. No longer needing to follow the prince, Gamache moved through the woods as fast as he could, weaving between trees. Brittle branches scraped his coat, his hands, his face. Once he had to stop as the mist grew thick and he lost his bearings. But he reoriented himself and pressed on. It took 10 minutes of slipping and slogging through mud and ankle-deep slush before he broke through to what was little more than an overgrown path. He could hear laboured breathing ahead of him, but it wasn't until he turned the corner that he saw Homer on the bridge, the mist rising from the Bella Bella almost enveloping him. But he wasn't alone. Carl Tracy's body was slung over his shoulder.
"Homer!"
Godin turned.
"Here,"
shouted Cameron from the back of the house.
"In the studio."
Beauvoir hurried back there, expecting to find Tracy, either cowering behind his pots or dead. Instead, he found Cameron standing by the back door.
"Godin must have gotten in this way," said Cameron.
"No sign of Tracy,"
said Beauvoir, pushing past Cameron.
"Jesus, there are footprints coming and going."
"There's blood on the floor," said Lacoste, pointing to the stains. "Not a lot. Someone's hurt, but doesn't look like a fatal stabbing. There'd be lots more blood."
"And a body," said Beauvoir. He stepped outside and saw what Gamache had seen. Not just two sets of prints, but one was deeper than the other.
"Homer must have taken Tracy with him."
"And the chief's following them,"
said Lacoste, pointing to another set of prints.
"Oh, God,"
said Cloutier. And when they turned to her, she said,
"He shouted something I didn't hear. I should have stopped and asked, but I just kept running."
Lacoste turned to Beauvoir.
"He thinks we're right behind him. He thinks he'll get backup."
Cameron started past Beauvoir to follow the prince and the man into the forest, but Beauvoir stopped him.
"Wait."
Every fibre in his body wanted to run into the woods. He could feel the others straining to do the same. But he remembered the chief's advice. "Think. Take a breath. Take a moment, just a moment, to think." So now, almost vibrating with the need to act, Jean-Guy Beauvoir thought.
"Godin's taking Tracy to the bridge."
Turning to Lacoste, he said, "Take the car. You two go with her." He pointed to Cameron and Cloutier. "You?" she asked. But Jean-Guy Beauvoir was already doing exactly what he always did. He was following Armand Gamache. By the time Lacoste reached the car, Jean-Guy Beauvoir and the other two agents were well into the forest, racing through the mist and trees.
"Drop him, Homer."
Godin, 20 paces ahead, was heaving for breath.
"Put him down."
As he spoke, Gamache approached, reaching into his pocket as he walked toward the bridge. Not for the gun still resting there, but for his phone. As Homer watched, Gamache stopped, pressed a button, and placed the phone on the ground, propped against a rock. There was no reception there, he knew. It couldn't send, but it could record. Homer, with Tracy unconscious and slung over his shoulder like a sack of potatoes, said nothing, did nothing, except stare at Gamache and gasp for breath. Gamache approached slowly, his hands out in front of him.
He couldn't see the knife. It was possible Homer had already used it and dropped it. Was Carl Tracy dead? But Gamache, who'd seen many, many bodies, didn't think so. There was still a pink hue to Tracy's hands as they hung limp. And there was no trail of blood, no sopping stain on Homer's coat, as there would be if he'd stabbed Tracy to death. Homer backed up a step. Two. Toward the gap in the railing, mended only with yellow police tape. And Armand knew what he planned to do, what he'd planned all along. He would follow his daughter into the water and take Tracy with him. Only parting ways in the afterlife, as Tracy went to hell and Homer went...
Fred, said Armand.
For a moment, Homer looked confused, then spoke.
Keep him! He's yours!
No, I mean, why didn't Vivian take Fred with her when she left?
He glanced behind him. Nothing. He'd expected Beauvoir and Lacoste to be there by now. He was running out of time, and Homer was running out of bridge. Gamache's only hope was to distract him long enough.
It doesn't make sense, said Gamache, as he stepped onto the bridge. She wouldn't leave without her dog. I don't understand. Do you?
Tracy made a sound, and Homer tightened his grip on him. If Gamache had hoped to engage Homer, break his focus, he'd failed. Homer looked blank, but not confused. He was certain about the only thing that mattered now. Gamache tried again, anything to stop Homer's slow progress toward the edge.
There's something else bothering me, he said. Tracy was at the art supply shop Saturday morning. Why didn't Vivian go to you then? Why didn't she leave earlier?
Again, nothing, just the vacant stare. Tracy moved now, groggy, and again Homer tightened his grip.
Stay still, Gamache begged the rising man. Don't move. You took $20,000 out of a bank to give to Vivian?
Yes.
Simple question, simple answer, but at least an answer. It gave Gamache information, but equally important, it created a tiny crack in Homer's focus. And maybe time for Jean-Guy and Isabel and the others to arrive. If he could just engage Homer. Though Armand was far from sure that it would matter. Homer took another step backward.
She asked for the money, he said.
Yes.
To raise it, you had to take a mortgage out against your home.
Homer gave one curt nod. Gamache took another step, farther onto the bridge.
Did you ask Lisette Cloutier about that? About how to do it? Did she know about the money?
I don't know. I might have. It doesn't matter.
Homer still looked dazed, but now something else had crept into his eyes. It wasn't quite fear, but he was wary. Now what, thought Gamache, could a man willing to kill himself be wary of? Something to do with Cloutier?
What is it, Homer? What do you want to tell me? What do you need to tell me?
I loved Vivian.
I know you did.
I have to do this. It's my fault. I have to make it right.
It's not your fault, and this won't make anything right, Homer. You must know that. Following one terrible act with another doesn't balance the books.
All those years of hurt. All the pain.
Homer was pleading with him now, trying to get Armand to see, to understand.
All the times I should have stopped it, but didn't. Kathy begged me. But
there was nothing you could do. You sent Vivian money. You mortgaged your home. You tried to see her, to help.
Annie's father stared at Vivian's father, his mind racing, trying to get a hold of something, anything that would penetrate Homer's resolve. But everything he said seemed to be making it worse. If that was possible. Homer hefted Tracy further onto his shoulder, tightening his grip.
You're wrong,
said Homer,
about everything. This isn't a terrible act. It's the one decent thing I can do for Vivian, to make up for all the damage, all the pain I caused her. I owe her this. You're right. This might not, what did you call it, balance the books. Not even close. But it's all I have left.
Armor heard a car door slam and saw Homer's eyes flicker over his shoulder.
Patron?
The sight that met Isabel Lacoste was chilling, but not surprising. Vivian's father was about to make good on his promise. He was about to throw Vivian's killer off the bridge. The only question was whether he'd go over with him. But that really wasn't in doubt, she knew, as she looked at his face. Beauvoir could see light through the trees, the opening, the road. They were almost there. He couldn't hear anything from up ahead, for all his crashing through the branches and undergrowth. But as soon as he broke through, he saw the Sûreté vehicles and, racing round the corner, saw immediately what was happening. He skidded to a stop. Armand felt the heft of Cameron's gun in his pocket and considered drawing it out, considered using it to wound the man, bring him down, but decided against it. Homer was too close to the edge, in every way. It would propel him over. And the threat of being shot wouldn't make him drop Tracy. It was no threat at all to a man about to do something far worse. It might even be a kindness, a coup de grace, a battlefield execution, to end his agony. Beauvoir had moved to one side of the road while Lacoste took the far side. They inched along the soft shoulder where the forest met the road. Once or twice, Homer's eyes flicked in his direction. The man clearly saw what Beauvoir was doing and didn't care. Beauvoir's breathing settled, but he remained taut, prepared to move fast. Though, like Lacoste and Gamache, he suspected it would not be nearly fast enough. Gamache had an idea, wild, desperate, and maybe the only thing that would stop Homer Godin from throwing Carl Tracy off the bridge. He didn't kill your daughter.
What?
Tracy. He didn't kill Vivian. The words, like a soft bullet, entered Vivian's father, and he stopped. Beauvoir and Lacoste glanced at each other. They were on either side of the narrow road, with Gamache between them, up ahead, on the bridge. They knew what he was doing, and it seemed to be working. Homer Godin was a decent man, driven mad by grief and despair. But he had no desire to kill anyone, except the person who'd murdered his daughter. If Gamache could convince him that Carl Tracy was innocent, at least of the murder.
Who?
Was all Homer could say, all he needed to say, his eyes wide, fixed on Gamache. Armand had no idea what to say, though he knew it didn't matter. He just had to come up with a name. Someone, anyone, would do. Anything to get Homer to drop Tracy and step away from the edge. He was just about to say the name of the one suspect not actually on the bridge, Pauline Vachon, when from behind him came a voice.
I did.
Homer shifted his gaze, and while Gamache was tempted to look behind him, he didn't. Didn't have to. He knew who'd spoken.
I'm sorry, Homer.
Lisette Cloutier had walked to just a few paces behind Gamache, and now she stepped forward until she was beside him. Beauvoir moved swiftly forward until he had one foot on the bridge, his hand on the rickety railing. He was just a few paces from Homer, could almost reach out and touch him. Homer was staring so intently at Cloutier, standing in the middle of the road, that he didn't notice Beauvoir off to the side. Now Beauvoir stopped, not wanting to spook the man.
Lisette,
whispered Homer.
I'm sorry, she repeated, her words coming out on a sigh. It was an accident. I didn't mean to. It just happened.
Why are you saying this?
He asked.
Because it's the truth. I was her godmother. I'd promised to look after her. You told me about Carl, about the abuse. She needed support,
needed money to get away. I felt awful that I hadn't done more, done anything to protect her. I'd promised Kathy, promised you.
Stay back, Gamache whispered as Lisette took a step toward Homer.
I'd saved up some money. I called her a week ago, told her I'd like to give it to her. She said she needed time to get things in order, but that she'd meet me here on Saturday night. She'd sneak away after her husband was drunk and passed out.
Homer was staring at her. He looked confused, and Gamache wondered how much he was taking in. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Beauvoir almost within reach of Homer. The mist rising from the Bella Bella was burning off in the early morning sun. They could see clearly now. Finally.
I got here first. Those boot prints were mine. When she arrived, she got out of her car. She had her duffel bag over her shoulder. I was about to give her the money when she said she was pregnant. A girl. A daughter.
Lisette looked down. No one moved. No one breathed. They were there now. At the end. Lisette mumbled something, and Homer shouted,
What's that? I can't hear. What are you saying?
She was so happy to tell me that. About the baby. I don't know what came over me, Homer.
Lisette's eyes and voice both rose.
I said something I shouldn't have. I told her I hoped her daughter was kinder to her than she'd been to her mother.
There was silence then, except for the Bella Bella rushing beneath them.
She was standing about where you are, said Lisette. She got upset, started yelling at me that I didn't know. It just...
She searched for words.
It just all came out, of both of us. She started screaming that it was all her mother's fault and how dare I...
She heaved and caught her breath.
And I shouted back, defending Kathy, even though I knew Viv was right. Oh, God.
They were frozen in place, a tableau, waiting for the rest.
She came at me, and I pushed her away, and...
And... Homer, perhaps in shock, maybe intentionally, loosened his grip on Carl Tracy. And Tracy, coming to, flailed as he fell to the ground, kicking, twisting, hitting Homer in the chest and sending him backward. Gamache jumped forward, but Beauvoir got there first. Homer's arms pinwheeled as he stumbled. He reached behind him, desperate for something to grab to stop his fall. But there was nothing there, just air. His eyes wide with terror, Homer began to go over the edge. Beauvoir got a handful of Homer's coat, and for a moment the momentum stopped. But Homer was too far gone. Beauvoir, still clinging to his coat, felt an almighty yank as Homer disappeared, dragging Jean-Guy with him. Time seemed to stand still. Jean-Guy felt, for a moment, as though he were hanging in midair, neither flying nor falling. He'd let go of Homer. The man was gone. Vivian's father was gone, into the river. And Jean-Guy was turned to the bridge, reaching for it. But it was just beyond his grasp. He was falling. Annie. Annie. Honoré. And then he fell. It all happened so fast, it seemed in slow motion. Gamache leaped off after him, following Beauvoir over the edge. With one hand he grasped the post, with the other he reached out, reaching, reaching. Jean-Guy's hand was stretching out toward him, Jean-Guy's eyes pleading. Then their hands touched and gripped. There was a yank as Jean-Guy's fall was stopped, but not for long, Gamache knew. His arm and shoulder had been wrenched. Slivers from the rotten wood were pushing into his palm, making it slippery with blood. He was losing his grip, on the post, on Jean-Guy. Jean-Guy was staring up at him, eyes wide with terror. Neither spoke. Neither could. In a moment, they'd both be in the river, the freezing water closing over them, not able to breathe for the shock, the cold, the turbulence, the roiling, turning them over and over, their bodies hitting rocks and tree trunks. Until all struggle left them, all breath left them, and finally all life left them, as their bodies bobbed and thumped down the Bella Bella, past St. Thomas's Chapel, past Miss Jane Neal's home, past Clara's, past the old railway station. Under the stone bridge they'd go, and come to rest at the bend in the river. He held Jean-Guy's frantic eyes and saw his lips move. Annie. And Armand could see what Jean-Guy was about to do.
"Don't," he rasped. "You dare."
But Jean-Guy did. Knowing Armand could not hold him and keep a grip on the bridge, Jean-Guy opened his grip, released his hand. Jean-Guy Beauvoir let go. But Armand did not. He closed his hand even tighter, even as he felt Jean-Guy's fingers squeezing through his own. All this took just moments, but felt like an eternity. Just as his hold slipped completely, Armand twisted and heaved, throwing Jean-Guy as far as he could, toward the shore. The effort pulled his hand from the bridge and turned his body onto its back, so that for a moment Armand was looking up, at the sky, into the April sunshine.
"Reine-Marie, Reine-Marie."
He heard a splash as Jean-Guy hit the water. Then his back arched and arms spread out, and he saw the river roiling below. Armand had managed to throw Jean-Guy clear of the worst of the torrent, but still he'd splashed down in deep water. Arms flailing, trying to get his head above the bone-chilling water, he felt the current grab him, sweeping him out into the river. Just as he was about to go under, hands gripped him. Water washing over him, retching and coughing, he felt himself pulled to shore. He looked up, through the brilliant sunshine and cascading water, to where he'd come from, afraid to see a void where Armand had been. Eyes screwed shut, Armand prepared to hit the water, then fight for his life. But instead, he was jerked to a stop. The blood rushed to his head, mixing with the rush of the river below, until the sounds were indistinguishable. Water into blood, blood into water. Then he looked up, into the smashed face of Bob Cameron, the tackle, penalized for holding too often and too tight. Holding on, tight. As Armand hung there, suspended, between the bridge and the water. Chapter 41. Reine-Marie hugged him, and he held her. Finally, letting go, Armand asked, "Is he all right?" She nodded.
"Hot bath, warm clothing. He's in the kitchen by the fire. Annie's on her way down." "Homer?"
Armand shook his head. Reine-Marie sighed.
"God."
Then she turned and embraced Isabel. When they entered the kitchen, Jean-Guy got to his feet. He was clutching a blue blanket around his shoulders and looked a little, though Armand would never ever say it to his face, like Ruth from Clara's portrait. Jean-Guy would not appreciate being told he looked like the old poet, never mind the Virgin Mary. When he'd gotten to the rocky shore, gagging and heaving, Jean-Guy had first made sure Armand was safe. Only then did he focus on the person bending over him. Wiping the Bella Bella from his eyes, Jean-Guy looked at Isabel Lacoste. Through chattering teeth, he managed,
"Thank you, thank you."
"Don't thank me," she said, putting her warm coat over Jean-Guy's shoulders.
"I just arrived. He got to you first."
She pointed to the person collapsed next to him. Soaking and shivering, there was Carl Tracy. He'd seen Beauvoir fall and had slithered quickly down the embankment to the river.
"You?"
said Beauvoir.
"Yeah, well,"
mumbled Tracy through blue lips.
"Sometimes you gotta do something stupid."
Hands trembling, Jean-Guy took off the warm coat and gave it to Carl Tracy. Safe now, warm and dry in the familiar kitchen, Jean-Guy walked over to Armand and, without a word, embraced him, then took the bandaged hand.
Merci.
They'd said the word together. Homer? Jean-Guy asked, as they subsided with groans into comfortable chairs by the wood stove.
Found at the bend in the river, said Isabel.
Where the Bella Bella left Three Pines.
Where Vivian was found?
Armand nodded. He'd stood on the banks of the river and waited for the divers to bring Homer ashore. The coroner, Dr. Harris, also waiting, noticed Armand's hand wrapped in a scarf. She'd taken the splinters out and put on disinfectant and a bandage. Lisette Cloutier had asked if she could be there when Homer's body was brought in. They'd agreed, and while Lacoste directed the recovery efforts, Lisette had stood next to Gamache, squinting into water that now gleamed and danced with reflected sunlight. Finally, when Homer was back, Gamache turned to her and asked,
"Why did you do it?" "Is she arrested?" Anne-Marie asked.
"Not yet," said Isabel. "She's outside with Cameron, waiting for the coroner's car to take the body away. I wanted to speak with you."
She turned to Jean-Guy.
"I think you should be the one to lay the charges and take her in, if you're up to it. Your last arrest. It was manslaughter, of course."
"No, it wasn't," said Armand. "She was lying."
"It was premeditated?" asked Jean-Guy. "She planned it?"
"We'll let her explain," said Armand. "She wants to talk. I've asked Cameron to bring her here, once she's seen Homer off." They'd get the truth this time, with or without malice. But first, Armand wanted to tell them what Homer had said to him on the bridge.
After the coroner's car drove away, Lisette Cloutier and Bob Cameron joined them around the wood stove. Anne-Marie, having heard what happened, gave Bob Cameron a bear hug. As he accepted the embrace, he breathed in the subtle scent of rose, and below that, barely there, a hint of sandalwood.
"Merci," she'd whispered into his ear. "Merci."
Lisette was trembling so badly with cold and shock that Armand did up a hot water bottle, while Anne-Marie wrapped her in a heavy Hudson's Bay blanket.
"Better?"
she asked, and got a small nod. Warmer, if not better. When they'd settled in again, hands around mugs of hot sweet tea, all eyes turned to Lisette Cloutier, who sat staring into the fire.
"I have a few questions, Agent Cloutier," Beauvoir said, pulling the blanket tighter as another wave of shivers passed through him. "To get things straight."
She nodded. No more fight left. Nothing to fight for anymore.
"If you killed Vivian, why did you get us involved? Why tell us she was missing in the first place?"
"I had to. How could I explain to Homer if I didn't? Besides, this way I could see what was happening."
"Not just see, but influence?"
"If necessary, oui."
"That Saturday night she was killed, you said you met Vivian on the bridge. How did you arrange that?"
"Like I said, I called and we set it up."
"But there are no records of your calling their home in the days before her death."
"I called from another line."
"No. Every number is accounted for. Every call. There weren't many, so it didn't take long."
"There were no calls from an unidentified number." Beauvoir put his tea down and leaned toward her, lowering his voice.
"So, how did you do it?"
"I called,"
she repeated.
"Why are you lying?" asked Beauvoir. "You know you didn't do it."
"What?" said Cameron, looking from Beauvoir to Cloutier, then back to Beauvoir. "Didn't do what?"
"Agent Cloutier didn't kill Vivian," said Chief Inspector Beauvoir.
"So it was Tracy," said Cameron. "We were right all along." He turned to Gamache. "You told Homer that Tracy didn't do it, but that was a lie. You just wanted him to drop Tracy."
"No,"
said Gamache, holding the gaze of the man who'd saved his life.
"I wasn't lying.
We were wrong all along. I was wrong. I'd warned you not to assume Tracy was guilty, and then I fell into the same trap. The evidence against Tracy was strong, but circumstantial. He was vile, but he was also telling the truth. Those posts between himself and Pauline Vachon were about the clay. That night, after their fight, he left Vivian bruised but alive. Carl Tracy did not murder his wife. She'd arranged to meet someone else on that bridge. His gaze was so prolonged, so considered, that Cameron shifted in his seat, his large body tensing, his damaged face alert. It felt like that moment just before the quarterback called out the last number, that moment suspended in time, just before they passed the point of no return. Gamache turned back to the others. "Before you arrived, I tossed things out to Homer, trying to break his concentration, anything that came into my head. And what did were the two nagging questions. Why didn't Vivian take Fred with her when she left home?" Once again, on hearing his name, Fred raised his head, not looking at the one who'd spoken. He was looking for someone who still hadn't returned. "The other was, why didn't she leave earlier that day?" said Gamache. "When Tracy was at the art shop." "There's only one answer," said Beauvoir. "She didn't leave in the morning, and she didn't take Fred with her to the bridge that night, because she didn't intend to go. Not yet, anyway. Her plan was always to leave with her lover." He stared at Cameron, who sat up straighter, the scars on his face turning white against his flushed face.
"But the call to her father," Cameron said, his voice raised. "She told him she was leaving that night. Coming to him, not to me. Him."
"No," said Beauvoir. "Vivian never planned to go to her father."
"She lied to him?"
asked Cameron. "No," said Beauvoir.
"So what does that mean?"
said Cameron. Then his face cleared, his eyes opened wider.
"Her father lied?"
He looked from one to the other of the senior officers.
"I don't understand. Why would he lie?"
"Did you know?" Isabel Lacoste asked Cloutier. Lisette Cloutier was very still for what felt like a long time, balancing on the knife edge.
"I suspected. Not right away, but there were things I knew."
"Like what?"
"On her deathbed, Kathy didn't just ask. She begged me to protect Vivian. Not guide her, not watch over her, but to protect her. This was before Vivian had even met Carl Tracy. So who was I supposed to protect her from? It didn't occur to me at the time to wonder. I was so upset I didn't think more about it, about the wording. But later..."
"Last summer, when Homer said Vivian told him to break it off with you," said Gamache.
"I began to wonder."
"What?"
asked Cameron, trying to catch up.
"Why she'd do that. Again, at the time, I was so hurt, I just accepted it. Accepted that Vivian was jealous and controlling and demanding of all her father's attention. But then I got to wondering if it was more than that."
"What?"
demanded Cameron.
"I don't get it."
"Don't you?" asked Gamache. "The money from Homer to his daughter. His decision to break off a relationship, not with just anyone, but Vivian's godmother, who is also a Sûreté officer."
"The payments into Vivian's account started last July," said Lisette. "Exactly when he ended the relationship. When I saw that, I wanted to believe it was a coincidence. But things started adding up."
"What was the money?" asked Cameron. "What are you saying?"
"Why did Vivian marry Carl Tracy?" Beauvoir asked. "Several people asked that question. We asked it. Why would a supposedly smart young woman marry a man so clearly violent, abusive? Madame Fleury gave us the answer."
"The devil she knew," said Gamache. "The damage done. Homer talked about that on the bridge. I didn't understand at the time. I was so focused on just trying to stop him. But when we were waiting on the shores of the Bella Bella for his body to be brought in, I went back over what he'd said. And then I realized something. He actually confessed."
"Oh my God,"
said Cameron.
"He beat her too, when she was growing up?"
"I think you saw it without realizing," said Gamache. "When she opened the door the first time, last summer, you saw the look in her eyes. You recognized in them what you see in the mirror. It was, I think, one of the things that drew you to her, a mutual hurt that went back to the earliest memories. Of course she'd marry an abusive man. It was all she knew, all she thought she deserved. Gamache looked at Cloutier. When did you begin to suspect?
I didn't. Not really. Not until I saw those payments.
What were they? Asked Cameron. Blackmail?
Restitution, said Lacoste. Vivian was already planning her escape last summer, about the time she miscarried. She probably suspected that Tracy had something to do with it. She knew she needed to get out, but she also needed money. So she contacted her father and demanded payment for all the pain.
And if he didn't pay, said Beauvoir, she'd tell her godmother all about it. I doubt Vivian even knew that you and her father had grown close.
So Homer broke it off with you and paid, said Gamache.
Over and over again on the bridge, he told us about the pain he'd caused Vivian, the hurt. He even said that his wife had begged him to stop it. I thought he meant stop Tracy abusing their daughter. But standing by the river, quietly going back over it, I remembered that Kathy had never met Tracy. She couldn't have meant him. So who did she mean? There was only one answer.
She was begging me to protect Vivian from her father, said Cloutier. From Homer. And I didn't. Worse, I'd fallen in love with him. I didn't see it. Didn't want to see it.
None of us did, said Gamache.
But you couldn't have saved Vivian if you had.
Cloutier's voice rose.
I could have. You didn't promise to protect her. I did. But instead, I actually blamed Vivian for being cruel to her father, for cutting him out of her life.
So that's why Tracy killed Vivian, said Cameron. He knew about that money.
But how would he? Asked Beauvoir. Would she really have told him? I think if she was going to confide in anyone about the money, it would be someone she trusted. A lover, for example. Don't you? His voice had grown quiet, almost a whisper, as he locked eyes with Cameron across the fire. Cameron flushed red, almost purple, and closed his hands into fists. There was something else Homer said on the bridge, said Gamache, before you all arrived. Or, actually, something he didn't say. He looked at the circle of faces, all of them focused on him. Even Cameron broke contact with Beauvoir and shifted his gaze. When he was preparing to take Tracy with him, he said it was punishment for all the years Tracy had hurt Vivian.
Yes, said Cameron. Exactly.
You're not listening, said Beauvoir.
Wait, said Lisette Cloutier, who understood what Gamache was saying. Wait, that can't be true.
Yes, it is, said Lacoste.
What?
Said Cameron, looking from one to the other. Homer Godin was punishing Tracy for abusing his daughter, Beauvoir explained, but not for killing her. He let that sink in. He never once said that, not on the bridge anyway, said Gamache.
Before, yes.
I think he'd convinced himself Vivian's death was Tracy's fault. If Tracy hadn't been abusing her, she'd never have needed to get away, never have needed to demand the money, never have needed to meet her father on the bridge. And Homer would not have killed her, said Beauvoir. The words sat there, no one protesting, no one denying them. It was, finally, the truth. Lisette Cloutier hung her head, dropping it toward her heart, while Bob Cameron, wide-eyed, absorbed what had been said.
I should have seen it sooner, said Beauvoir quietly.
Only two numbers were called from the house that day. One a wrong number. The other was to her father. Vivian was on that bridge to meet someone, and it could only be the one person she'd spoken to that day. Her father. Finally, it was that simple. That obvious.
But what about Fred?
Asked Renmarie. And once again the dog raised his head, then lowered it to his paws.
Why did she leave him behind?
Her plan was never to go away that night, said Armand. She wanted to get the money from her father, then return home and talk to you.
He turned to Cameron. That's why she didn't leave when Tracy was at the art store, and that's why she didn't take Fred to the bridge. You didn't break off the affair last fall, did you?
No, I broke it off just after Christmas. I couldn't do that to my family.
Gamash nodded. I think she genuinely believed the child was yours. She wanted to tell you, said Beauvoir, and see if maybe...
I'd go with her, he said.
He didn't tell them what his answer would have been, nor did they ask. She called over and over, trying to get through to you, said Beauvoir. She finally gave up and went to the bridge to meet her father.
But if she'd refused to see him since she left home, why agree to meet him that night? Asked Cameron.
Yes, said Cloutier. The money could have been wired into her account like all the rest. No need to see him at all. The baby, said Beauvoir. That changed everything. The idea of being a parent changes you. Cameron nodded, remembering his own mounting terror as his first child grew in his wife's womb, that maybe he'd be his father. Maybe he'd be impatient, cruel, violent. Maybe he'd lash out, with fists, with a belt, with a baseball bat.
She needed to face her abuser, said Cameron. Look him in the eye. Confront him.
As he'd confronted his own father before his son was born. Only then did he know, in his heart, that he would love his children, protect his children. He would never hit them. And he had not. Yes, said Beauvoir. Vivian met her father on the bridge for one reason, to look him in the eye and tell him what he'd done to her. She had to do it for her own sake, but also for her daughter's. It wasn't about the money, said Lacoste. That was the excuse to get him there. There was silence as some looked down at the floor, some stared into the fire, and others looked out the window at the bright, cheerful day, at the three huge trees swaying, playing in the breeze.
Do you think her plan was to kill him? Asked Cameron.
No, said Gamache. If it was, she'd have taken Tracy's rifle. She had no weapon. I think it was as Chief Inspector Beauvoir says. She wanted her freedom, not another burden. Killing her father would have bound him to her for the rest of her life. But oh, thought Armand, the courage it must have taken to face him. And in doing that, turn her back on all the justified rage, all that had maddened and tormented her entire life. To rid herself of all the subtle demonisms of life and thought, Vivian had to stand on that bridge and face them, face him. Her courage was almost unimaginable. And once free, something went wrong, Beauvoir said quietly. Maybe she tripped, maybe he pushed her away. If he did, I don't think he meant to kill her. But maybe that was wishful thinking. I realize now that he almost told me what happened, said Armand. That afternoon, when the case was thrown out, we stood out there. He nodded toward the path along the Bella Bella, and I told him how sorry I was. He talked about forgiveness and asked if some things were too horrible to forgive. I thought he was talking about Tracy's acquittal. He asked if a sincere apology really helped. Armand looked into the fire, remembering Homer's worn face, the exhaustion in those eyes.
I think he told her, on the bridge that night, how sorry he was, and asked forgiveness.
Do you think he meant it? Renmarie asked.
I want to believe he did. Yes. Mostly, though, Armand hoped and prayed that the last thing Vivian Godin saw wasn't the monster coming at her out of the dark again, but her father reaching out, trying to save her. They'd never know the full truth, but they could hope.
Chapter 42 So I'm confused, said Gabri.
We know you are, said Ruth, patting his hand, and so's Olivier. Gaze and confused.
Homer killed his own daughter, said Gabri, ignoring her.
It looks like it, said Olivier.
They were sitting in the bistro over after-dinner drinks. Gabri was shaking his head.
It's all so sad.
And confusing? Asked Ruth.
Yes. Why would he do it?
Those cops explained it all, said Ruth. Weren't you listening?
By those cops, you mean Armand, Jean-Guy and Isabel? Asked Olivier.
Whoever. But yes, That's what they said. Homer did it.
They, of course, had said slightly more than that. The villagers had seen Armand and Jean-Guy, Isabel and the other officers, return to Three Pines that morning. Jean-Guy, wet, cold, bruised, had gone straight to the Gamache home, while Armand, dishevelled, slightly wild-eyed, hand wrapped in a scarf, had walked with Isabel and the others to the path through the woods that took them to the bend in the river where the Bella Bella left Three Pines. A few minutes later, an ambulance, Sûreté cars, the coroner returned. Homer was discovered exactly where Vivian had been found, knocking gently up against a huge tree trunk. Only then did Armand and Isabel return home, watched by Clara, Gabri, Olivier, by Billy Williams and Myrna, by Ruth with Rosa, who was silent for once, though she did watch Armand with sad eyes, but then ducks were often sad. By that afternoon, the sun was out in full force. Snowdrops and fragrant, delicate lily of the valley were beginning to appear. Crocuses broke through the grass of the village green. Life had not just been restored, it had burst forth, as Isabel, Jean-Guy, Armand and Reine-Marie walked into the bistro. They joined Clara and Ruth and Rosa by the fieldstone fireplace. Billy Williams sat at a distance from Myrna, but stole glances at her. Catching her eyes once, he smiled, and when Myrna smiled back, he blushed and looked away. Olivier brought them café au lait and warm almond croissants, then perched on the arm of the large chair next to Gabri. The fire crackled in the background as they heard what had happened. Ruth looked down at her thin, veined hand holding Gabri's pink, pudgy one.
"You would have a different body by then, an old, murky one, a stranger's body you could not even imagine, and you would be lost and alone."
But not lost, she thought, and not alone. That evening, Clara was in her studio. Ruth's final comment as she left to head home, ringing in her ears.
"Maybe there's a reason they call it a stool," she'd said, nodding to where Clara sat in front of the easel. "Something to think about."
Fuck, fuck, fuck. But this time it didn't come from the duck. Once she stopped muttering, Clara turned to Myrna, who was sitting on the sofa, her bottom resting on the concrete floor, her knees up around her ears.
"Homer kept saying he was going to kill Tracy," said Clara. "He even tried. Why would he do that if he knew Tracy hadn't killed his daughter? Was it an act?"
"I don't think so," said Myrna.
"You think Armand and the others might be wrong, and Tracy really did kill Vivian?"
"No, I think Homer was mad with grief, with guilt. I think he couldn't bear to accept what he'd done. All those years of abuse, and then being responsible for Vivian's death."
"And his granddaughter's?"
"Yes. I think his own self-loathing and his anger at Tracy for his abuse of Vivian got all mixed up. He saw himself in Tracy and decided both must die. It's pretty obvious by what Armand said that Homer meant to take his own life along with Tracy's. Both must go into the river."
"To be cleansed?" asked Clara.
"To be punished."
"You think his grief was real? It sure seemed real. Fooled everyone, including Armand."
"I don't think anyone was fooled. I think Vivian's death destroyed Homer. I doubt it was on purpose. I want to believe he went to the bridge to try to make amends."
"I don't understand," said Clara. "He beat her, his own daughter, a child. God knows what else he did her. And now what? You're saying he really did love her?"
"I'm saying people change."
She held up her hands to ward off Clara's protests.
"I know, it's easy to say, and it doesn't undo the damage. But we've seen changes of heart, changes of perception. It happens. Racists, homophobes, misogynists, they can change. And some do."
"Truth and reconciliation," said Clara.
"Yes, the truth must come first, and then, maybe, reconciliation. Maybe."
"You think Vivian and her father might have reconciled?"
"Maybe. I think getting the courage to confront him was the first step.
if not to forgiveness, at least to healing. And I think Homer's willingness to meet her and to take the money shows that maybe he wanted that too. Maybe.
He killed her, Clara reminded Myrna. Then he was willing to see Carl Tracy tried and convicted for something he himself did. Hardly the acts of a contrite man.
True, Myrna pushed herself out of the sofa. I guess I just want to believe.
Just as she'd wanted to believe, desperately, that Clara's miniatures were brilliant. But that had proved a delusion. Dominica Oddly had made that clear, and had, with a few well-turned phrases on her site, destroyed Clara's credibility as an artist. Her gallery had dropped her. Collectors were returning paintings. Social media was on a feeding frenzy. Myrna looked at the tiny paintings nailed to the wall where Clara had put them, where she could always see them, a reminder, a warning. Oddly had been right about them, but she'd also been wrong. She might have a duty to tell the truth, but there was no need to be so cruel.
Are you going to do a portrait of her? Asked Myrna.
Her who? Vivian? I never met her.
No, you know who I mean.
Myrna waited for the answer that would reveal so much about her friend's state of mind. But Clara didn't answer. Or maybe she did, thought Myrna, as she watched her friend stare into the vast, white, empty expanse of canvas in front of her and put down her brush. Jean-Guy Beauvoir pulled the car into the now familiar yard, and he and Armand got out. The donkeys noticed first, coming over to the fence to greet them.
What do you want?
Demanded Carl Tracy, once again standing at the barn door with a pitchfork.
Come to arrest me? I keep telling you, I didn't kill Vivian.
Jean-Guy looked at the man and felt a wave of revulsion. He might not have killed his wife, but he beat her, isolated her, tormented her. But Carl Tracy had also done something else.
No, said Beauvoir. I've come to thank you for saving my life.
He didn't offer his hand, couldn't take it that far, but he did look Carl Tracy, his unexpected saviour, in the eyes, and saw there surprise, and even, maybe, a softening, a hint of what this man could have been, might still become, might actually be, deep inside. Carl Tracy's actions on the bridge had been instinctive. Maybe, below all the rot, there existed some timid decency.
Yeah, well, a blow to the head'll do that.
Was there, as he said it, the smallest possible smile?
And I came to apologise, said Gamache, for having you arrested, charged. I was wrong, and I'm sorry.
You're kidding,
said Tracy, scanning the woods, the road, behind the Sûreté officers.
This is a trap, right?
Did Carl Tracy go through life looking for, seeing, manufacturing traps set by others for him? How, Gamache wondered, must that affect how he sees the world? It didn't forgive the abuse, the violence. It wasn't Gamache's to forgive, but it might help explain it.
No, no trap. An apology.
While Jean-Guy backed the car up, Armand watched through the windshield as Tracy fed the donkeys carrots and scratched their long noses. Superintendent Lacoste crossed her legs and smoothed her slacks and looked across the coffee table at Chief Superintendent Toussaint. It had been a week since the events in Three Pines, and her leave was coming to an end. She was meeting with Toussaint to tell the head of the Sûreté which job she'd accept.
I saw your tweets, Isabel, said Madeleine Toussaint as they settled into the comfortable armchairs in the sitting area of the office. Defending Chief Inspector Gamache. You didn't hide your identity.
Why should I?
Because you used your rank. You were posting not as a private citizen, but as a senior officer in the Sûreté, making it look like the official Sûreté position.
As it should have been.
I waited, you know, for someone more senior to defend him.
She glared at Toussaint.
And when that didn't happen?
There are issues you're not aware of.
What issues exactly make it okay to attack our own?
I didn't attack him.
Oh, no? You think I don't know where that video came from?
Lacoste demanded.
What video?
But Lacoste had seen the surprise in Toussaint's eyes, the tensing of her body, a spasm of alarm, of fear even.
When the shit was flying, he made sure it didn't stick to you, said Lacoste, leaning forward. You do know that Monsieur Gamache was the one who recommended you for this job?
He's not the only reason I got it.
True? You got it because the Premier asked you not to defend Monsieur Gamache in the hearings, and you agreed.
That's a lie.
It's the truth.
Toussaint's jaw clamped shut, and her eyes hardened. The problem with going up against Isabelle Lacoste was that she was a hero, unassailable, and a die-hard defender of Gamache.
Be careful, Isabelle. It's never a good idea to catch a falling knife.
Toussaint knew that while Superintendent Lacoste might be beyond reach, Gamache was not. When the smoke had cleared on that final, fateful raid, and Isabelle Lacoste lay in her own blood, Chief Superintendent Gamache had to answer for his decisions. Madeleine Toussaint had known, even as she stood in those woods surveying the wreckage, that he could never really explain his actions to anyone who wasn't there. Even as they made sweeping arrests in the most successful raid in decades, the vultures were circling. Politicians desperate to rid themselves of this inconvenient person. A vicious and ravenous social media, desperate for fodder. On his last day in command, before being suspended, he'd recommended Toussaint for his job. A black woman, a Haitian. They'd stood in this office. He shook her hand and told her she'd be great. But he had one request.
Don't defend me, Madeleine. You won't win, and they'll come after you.
But
promise me.
When the Board of Review took their shot, no one in power had stepped in front of Armand Gamache to stop it. Chief Superintendent Gamache had gone down, and Superintendent Toussaint had risen up. But what no one expected was that Gamache would actually return, would accept such a demotion. With the departure that evening of Jean-Guy Beauvoir to Paris, Gamache once again took over the homicide department. Respected by colleagues and subordinates, he was viewed with suspicion and worse by those who feared the power he wielded, no matter his official rank. And Madeleine Toussaint had grown used to her own power, used to the office, the deferential looks, the salutes, the respect of her community. She wasn't about to give it up, but to hold on to it, she had to diminish Gamache. And that meant one thing, a purge of his most powerful supporters.
I've been looking at your health records, Isabelle.
She nodded at the dossier on the table between them.
The Sûreté demands a certain level of fitness, especially in its leaders. We have to act as role models.
Yes, said Lacoste. I know. I also know there are different sorts of fitness.
The words hit home, but Toussaint tried not to show it.
I'm sorry to say we'll have to pension you off. While you keep most of your salary and your benefits, I'll have to ask for your ID and your weapon back. Your security code will no longer be valid.
If she'd expected an argument, Toussaint was disappointed. Isabelle Lacoste just nodded and put her hand in her pocket to bring out her Sûreté ID. But instead, what she brought out was her cell phone. Propping it against some books on the table, she hit play. Chief Superintendent Toussaint watched with thin lips and narrow eyes. She watched Jean-Guy Beauvoir dive across the screen, reaching for the falling man. She watched as he grabbed a handful of the man's coat and hung on, even as he himself was dragged over the edge. Her eyes widened as she watched Gamache leap forward. No time to think. He reacted instinctively. She no longer saw him. He'd disappeared over the edge of the bridge. But she did see his hand, white-knuckled, gripped onto the foot of the post. As she watched, the hand began to slip. Her mouth opened a little as the finger slid off. Isabelle Lacoste leaped forward to grab the hand, but someone was there before her. The former tackle, Cameron, was on his belly, reaching over the side. There were shouts for help, cries for help, a splash. All this the chief superintendent knew. She'd read the report. But knowing and seeing were two different things. Lacoste picked up her phone and turned it off. Then she took an envelope out of her pocket and, placing it on the table, slid it toward the chief superintendent. Isabel Lacoste knew that the doctored video purporting to show Gamache killing unarmed kids had come from Toussaint. It was done to discredit her predecessor, not expecting the real video to be found, and released by some crazy old woman in a village that didn't even officially exist. And now it was gaining ground, overtaking the fake. Gamache's own reputation was not only being restored, it was growing. And this video, if released, would put the final lie to Toussaint's doctored effort to show Gamache as a psychotic coward. "What do you want?" Toussaint asked. "That," Lacoste gestured toward the envelope, "is the job I want. The job I will have." Toussaint nodded, knowing, of course, what it said. While Gamache could not be made chief superintendent, Isabel Lacoste could. Toussaint picked up the envelope, tore it open, and read. Then she looked across the table at Isabel Lacoste, perplexed at first, then realization growing.
"You must be kidding."
Chapter 43.
"We need to go," said Annie. "They've almost finished boarding."
Armand's Sûreté credentials had gotten him and Reine-Marie past security. They stood with Annie and Jean-Guy by the gate at Trudeau International Airport. Honoré was in Reine-Marie's arms, while Armand and Jean-Guy struggled with the travel stroller.
"Here," said Reine-Marie.
She handed the child to Annie, walked over to them, pressed a button, lifted some nylon, and up it folded. The two men nodded to each other, Laurel and Hardy style.
"Can I leave him here and bring you to Paris, Maman?"
"Oh, don't ask me twice," said Reine-Marie, taking Honoré back.
Dropping her face to his hair, she took a deep breath, then handed him to his grandfather. The Air Canada representative approached. "I'm sorry, but we're closing the gate."
"Merci,"
said Annie, and looked at her father.
"See you soon, buddy,"
Armand whispered to the tired child, almost asleep in his arms.
"You'll love Paris. What an adventure you'll have. And you'll see your cousins, Florence and Zora."
He held Honoré in the pocket of his shoulder, resting his cheek on the little head for a moment. Then he kissed his forehead and whispered,
"I love you."
The boy put his small hand on his grandfather's large one, holding it there.
"Dad,"
said Annie, putting out her arms. Armand handed Honoré back to his mother.
"Before I go, I want to give you this," said Jean-Guy, holding out an envelope.
"Money?"
asked Armand as he took it. Jean-Guy laughed.
"No, a name. The person I'm recommending as your second in command."
"Hope they're better than your last one," said Armand.
"Hard to be worse," agreed Jean-Guy. "It is, of course, your decision."
"Does this person know?"
"They applied, and yes, they do know about the recommendation."
He nodded to the envelope.
"I used one of the things you taught me when making my decision about your second in command."
"You mean the four statements that lead to wisdom?" asked Armand.
Jean-Guy shook his head.
"The three questions to ask yourself before speaking?"
Again, Jean-Guy shook his head.
"Then what?"
"Sometimes you just have to do something stupid."
Armand raised his brows, and Annie turned to her mother.
"Oh, dear God. Don't tell me that's the lesson he's taken from Dad." "I thought your dad got it from him."
Armand put the envelope in his pocket. He knew the name it contained. Bob Cameron, a lowly agent, not even an inspector. Gamache hadn't considered him. Cameron had potential, but still, giving him such a promotion would be a hard sell to his superiors and the rest of the unit. But if someone can drop far, maybe he can also rise fast. Armand put out his hand to Jean-Guy, who took it and held it, and looked into those familiar eyes, and saw that, after all these years, after all that had happened, after all the pain and hurt, one thing had not changed. In those eyes, he still saw kindness. And Armand, looking deep into Jean Guy's, saw below all the pain, all the hurt, all the ghosts, a gleam, a beam of kindness. "I'll find a way to be useful," Jean Guy whispered.
"Patron." "And so will I, patron."
Then he embraced Annie.
"I love you. Take care of yourself. If you need anything, anything at all."
"I know, Dad. I love you too."
The young family disappeared through the door, Honoré holding up his hand to wave goodbye. It was the secret wave he and his grandfather had worked out after Great-Aunt Ruth had shown the boy the one-finger wave. Papa had explained that really three fingers were even better, for the three pines. Armand raised his hand and waved back. Then they were gone, to start their new life in the City of Light. Once home, Reine-Marie poured them each a scotch, while Armand walked Henri and Gracie, and Fred, slowly around the village green. He looked up as a plane moved overhead, among the stars. The next morning, the villagers gathered to dismantle the wall of sandbags. All danger was past. Then, led by Myrna, they walked down the path beside the Bella Bella, past young fiddleheads and lily of the valley and crocuses in the woods, to the bend in the river. Lighting candles and a stick of dried sage, they smudged the area, blessed the area, said a prayer for the dead and the living. Then all walked back to the bistro for breakfast. But Armand and Reine-Marie stopped at the bench on the village green, a peaceful place in the bright sunshine. They watched robins hop on the grass. They smelled wood smoke and mud, and sweet pine. Armand put his hand into his coat pocket and felt the envelope there. He'd forgotten it, but now brought it out.
"What's that?"
Reine-Marie asked.
"From Jean Guy, his suggestion for my second-in-command."
After he'd opened it, he smiled and put it back in his pocket. Beside him, Reine-Marie closed her eyes and tilted her face up. Then they walked back to the bistro to join the others. Unheard by anyone else, Armand bent down and whispered to Ruth,
"I forgive you, but don't ever do it again."
"Do what?"
"You know."
While he couldn't bring himself to say the words, especially to the elderly woman, even this elderly woman, he brought out his phone and showed her. The Twitter handle, @Domas, and the link to the Real Sûreté video of the raid on the factory. There were other posts by @Domas defending Gamache. But when the video went up, they'd stopped. There was no longer any need to defend him once that vile video went viral.
"How did you find it?" he asked.
"I didn't. You think I'd defend you?"
"I do."
"I would," the old poet admitted. "I did. But that's not me."
Armand stepped back and stared at Ruth. He knew her to be many things, but never a liar. So if she wasn't @Dumbass, who was? Madeleine Toussaint sat at her desk and opened her computer. Putting in her Sûreté code, she went back over her posts aimed at Gamache and deleted them all, pausing just a moment at the final one. Then Chief Superintendent Toussaint hit delete, and @Dumbass disappeared. Never, she prayed, to be found. Because if anyone knew, if the Premier found out she'd defied him and defended Gamache by posting the real video, it was an act of contrition, an amend. And now they were even, and she owed her former mentor nothing. Looking across the room, her eyes fell on the last remnant of the last occupant, something she kept meaning to take down, but had kept up. The framed poster, nailed to the wall by the door, the first and last thing seen each day. Noli timere. Armand sat on the sofa beside Reine-Marie and reached for the café au lait Olivier had brought them. He seemed distracted, but now he reached into his pocket and handed Reine-Marie the envelope.
"You might want to read this."
"Jean Guy's recommendation?" She put on her reading glasses. "Will you take it?"
"I think so."
Armand watched her face as Reine-Marie read. He saw the smile and relief as she stared at Jean Guy's familiar hand and the name he'd so carefully written. Armand's new second-in-command, Isabelle Lacoste. Reine-Marie lowered the paper to her lap and looked into the fireplace. "Everything might be all right after all," she thought.
This is Robert Bathurst. We hope you've enjoyed A Better Man by Louise Penny, a Macmillan audio production from Minotaur Books. This programme was produced by Matty Argyropoulos, directed by Lorelei King, recorded by Naomi Graham, post-production by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 2019 by Three Pines Creations, Inc. Production copyright 2019 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.